That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, 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 everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. We are here live on FUBAR Radio. I am your host for the next hour or so, Gabriel, aka That Money Guy. And like I said right at the start, this is That Money Show, the one, the only place to come on a Monday afternoon to hear everything about money. Our objective is very, very simple. Every week, you come in and we make you that little bit better with your money. But how? How can we do that, I hear you ask? Well, it's a very good question. We've got a few different tactics, because we know not everyone learns the same way. So we're going to do a few things with you here today. Number one, we are going to bring you up to speed on the news. Not the boring news, not the news that's really depressing, but the news that actually affects the money in your pocket. Actually, sometimes that news is a little bit depressing. But hopefully today, we've got some more positive stories. Well, you'll find out if you stick around. And then, of course, we bring in some of the coolest, the most interesting, and some of the biggest guests in both the finance industry and beyond that. A range of experts, some famous faces, some personal finance experts to kind of share some life experiences and some advice. And this week, we've got Tom Allingham. For those of you who don't know, he is the communications director at Save the Student. Not sure if any of you are aware, but the price of going to university is going up. So bringing someone from Save the Student, well, that makes a lot of sense. And secondly, we are bringing in Kia Commodore, the content creator and founder of Pennies to Pounds. If you haven't heard of Kia, then what are you doing? And if you have heard of her, then you know that she's a brilliant financial educator. She's just released a book. She's won awards. So, yeah, stick around. This is going to be an absolutely bloody brilliant show. Shall we talk about the news? Yes, we shall. Don't really know who I was asking there. There's no one else in the room except for me right now. What's going on? Well, the big financial news of the week is interest rates. The Bank of England have cut interest rates down from 5 to 4.75%. Now, if you do not like numbers, what I've just said to you is probably the most boring thing in the world, but it's actually quite important. So stick around and you'll understand why. And literally in 3 to 4 minutes' time, I will have already made you better with money. For us money nerds out there, this was both the biggest news of the week, but also the most expected news of the week. So the Bank of England set an interest rate, and a lot of things happen off the back of that. Number one, a lot of borrowing is affected and set by the high street banks based off the Bank of England's base rate. And on top of that, a lot of savings rate and savings accounts, the interest that you get on those, you know, those fun accounts that you put your savings, short-term and long-term savings into, are also affected and kind of linked to the rate set by the Bank of England. So the Bank of England this week went, we're going to go down. They were at 5.25 a few months ago. They went down to 5. And now they are down at 4.75% as of last week. So what does that actually mean for you? Well, it depends. You need to describe yourself right now as either a saver or a borrower. Do you borrow money? Do you have a mortgage? Do you have a car finance loan that's linked to the base rate and stuff like that? Or are you looking to potentially borrow more money in the future? Because if so, this is good news, especially for you mortgage holders. And why is that? Well, a drop in interest rate theoretically means that borrowing becomes that little bit cheaper. We get lower interest rates when we try and borrow money, thus a good thing when they lower interest rates. On the flip side, if you are a saver and you are someone looking to get the most interest in an account, then about you, but my current short-term easy access accounts give me 5.17%. Yep, that's right, 5.17%. Well, it's not good news because a lot of banks, digital banks, high street banks, lenders, all that kind of stuff, are going to start to lower the rate that you can get as an interest rate on these accounts. A lot of them might have already done this immediately the moment they heard the news. A lot of them might implement it in the next week or so and waiting to kind of see what their competitors do. So this is what has happened and what it is likely to cause within the market. Like I told you, this isn't just any news. This is the relevant news that affects the money in your pocket. And we have literally just broken that down for you right now. So why did they drop the interest rate? Well, it was quite expected. It was 8 votes to 1. So 9 people vote on this every single, 6-week period. 9 votes, because therefore it can't be a split. And this time 8 people voted for the drop. 1 person voted for the hold. However, we are told that the future cuts they will come, but they aren't going to come very, very quickly. One of the key reasons why cuts aren't going to come from now on as quickly as we might have hoped or as fast as we might have expected is because of the budget that happened last week. Is it 2 weeks ago now? Bloody hell. Is the budget old news? I can't even keep up anymore. But yeah, the budget basically has caused a slight inflationary pressure on the economy. Inflation is expected to be a little bit higher for a little bit longer. We're not talking 11%. Everyone relax, calm down. We're not even talking 10%. We're just talking a little bit higher. And the higher the inflation, the higher the Bank of England like to keep or hold their interest rate. So that's kind of the balance between the two and why we might not get, well, you know what? A few weeks ago, there was an assumption that we might get another cut in 6 weeks' time before the end of the year to go down to 4.5%. That's looking very, very unlikely. Most people are not predicting that in any way, shape or form. All right, what's going on? What else is going on in the news, people? Well, 2 in 5 households will struggle to pay the predicted increase in water bills, according to the Water Watchdog. So what's going on? Why are water bills going up? What? Water bills? Well, a lot of water companies, I don't know if anyone's been keeping up in the news, have kind of run themselves into the ground. They haven't been run very, very well. And as a result, the infrastructure, the water infrastructure, the sewage, etc., needs a complete upgrade, a complete huge amount of reinvestment. Now, whilst they can look to investment to try and get the money to do all of these repairs and improve the systems, they're also going to look to you. Yeah, that's right. You paying your water bill to try and pay a little bit more so they can get more money within, you know, well, their pockets to try and hopefully reinvest that into the systems. What does this rise actually look like? Well, the expectation by Ofwat, yeah, they're the people that kind of look into the they're the regulators for water, assume an average of £19 a year increase. That's 21% by 2030. That's a huge amount of money. But if you think that's huge, water firms are currently trying to get as much as 84%. So let's see if Ofwat will allow that or not. 84%, that seems a little bit extreme. I don't know if you agree with that. But what has the response been like to this announcement of water bills being on the up? Well, 43% said they would use less water. 54% of people are saying they would cut back on non-essential bills to afford water. And 38% said they would spend less on essentials, including things like food shopping, in order to be able to pay for water. In other words, people cannot afford this shit, genuinely. Like, they cannot afford the water to keep going up. Well, this bill rise. But it looks like it's coming regardless. So, we're not just going to give you the bad news. We're going to try and help you out a little bit with what can you do to try and prepare yourself for this rise in the price of water. Well, number one is, if you don't use a lot of water, and this isn't like if you're a family of 8, but you don't use a lot of water, because I think if you're a family of 8, you probably use a lot of water. But let's say you live on your own, for example, you might want to consider installing a water meter, like your electricity meter, like your gas meter. It measures the amount of water you use. And if you are a low user, you would probably benefit from, you know, portraying that information to the water company and therefore paying less compared to the average amount they assume your household uses. Number two, if you are on benefits of any kind, you please, please, please look to see if you can get any kind of, well, additional benefit for the price of water. And lastly, I believe there is a social tariff actually for water where you can pay a reduced amount depending on your salary. So if you are in one of the, if you're in a lower earning household, or if you're even in a sort of average earning household, but you have a huge amount in terms of your water bill every single month, then just take a look into something called the social tariffs for your water bill to see, again, if you can drop the price on your water. All right. Shall we keep going with the news? Yeah, we absolutely should. Here's a question for you. Do you use cash? Sorry, what? Yeah, that's right. If you open up your drawer right now, if you're next to a drawer, if not, then maybe like go into your wallet. Any cash in there? Any coins? Anything like that? Well, the reason I ask, because MPs on the Treasury Select Committee are calling for evidence to determine if new rules are needed to make cash acceptance mandatory across Britain. That's right. The opposite of what you think I was about to say. They are looking to see if they need to make cash acceptance mandatory. This is probably actually starting to make sense to a few of you who have gone into a number of shops where they have like a sign saying, we only take card. pretty crazy that we've gotten to the place where we only take card. And do you want to know why they do that? Well, the current estimates are that 22 million people in the UK are cashless. The UK is actually one of the most advanced economies when it comes to kind of the fintech and the payments world. Like, even if you go to somewhere like America, they have nowhere near the level of capabilities like with Apple Pay and all this kind of touch card payment, etc., as we have here. And so we are becoming a hugely cashless society. But there is a huge number of people that are struggling or being negatively impacted because of that, especially the older generations who aren't kind of adapting or, you know, taking on this cashless world, and they still would like to use cash. Now, obviously, you can imagine this is a huge struggle for them. If, I don't know, your nan wants to go down to the local whatever supermarket and they don't take cash and she only has cash because she doesn't have Apple Pay because she doesn't have an iPhone or a smartphone, you can see why this might be a problem for the more vulnerable people. So, they're thinking about making it mandatory for all businesses. Do I think this is a good idea? Well, I think for a lot of places do still allow you to pay in both, and they should always kind of try and keep this because there's a lot of money still in circulation. I'm talking about physical money. Apparently around 3.1 million people in the UK rely almost entirely on cash as a form of payment, and 1.5 million people use it as a main spending tool. So cash is still very relevant. That's still 5-ish% of the UK that see it as a huge reliance on cash. And I think we can just ignore that 5%, especially if you want, you know, to decrease, I suppose, the revenue your business can make by 5% because you're stopping 5% of people essentially shopping in your store. I mean, I'm trying to think personally. So from my own perspective, I do have cash. I don't think I have used it in a very, very, very long time. Like, I get a bit of cash from, like, my grandma on my birthday, and I'm actually not sure if I've even spent it. My birthday was in July, and I'm probably fairly certain that money is still sat in my drawer somewhere. So I don't remember the last time I went out into public with cash. But I think that whether this needs to be compulsory or not, that is a bit of a debate. But potentially, especially for the more vulnerable people in society, as we kind of start to adopt this cashless economy. But for now, should it be mandatory? No, but should most shops probably try and keep it in so they can not, you know, drop their revenue by 5%? Probably sounds like a pretty, pretty good idea to me. Anyway, that's everything from the news. Let me know what you think. I could have brought in someone like Donald Trump, but I don't really want to talk about, you know, someone who's a little bit narcissistic. I mean, we'll keep everyone's opinions to themselves on what happened in the US. I was actually going to go into it down a whole rabbit hole there. I'm going to avoid that. I'm going to go to a break and take a deep breath. So stick around, because coming up straight after this is Tom Allingham, the communications director at Save the Student.
FUBAR Radio.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the truth. Okay. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SIS sister.
That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
What would you be advising the Labour leadership to do at this point?
My view is just apologise. I went to the theatre last night. I'm with my wife and family, and as I'm walking, a bloke says very loudly, John McDonnell, has he paid for his tickets? I went back to the bloke, said, yeah, I did pay for my tickets, and I always do. What that whole ticketing thing and all the free gifts thing doesn't just damage those individuals, it damages us all, because they all think, oh, they're all the same, and we're not.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel Nussbaum, that money guy. And it's time to talk to you students out there. Well, potential students, current students, future students, mainly future students, because starting in 2025, as of last week, universities in England can charge up to £9,535 per year for full-time and undergraduate students, undergraduate courses, as well as maintenance loans going up by 3.1% to help with living costs. This is, of course, up from the current tuition fee of £9,250. Well, joining me now is Tom Allingham, the Communication Director at Save the Student, who will know a lot more about this than I will. Tom, how are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, Gabriel. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I'm really interested to hear your take on this, because when that announcement came out, I remember like last Monday now, there was a lot of fears that this was going to go up to £12,000, £13,000, £14,000 for tuition fees. So it has only actually gone up a little bit. And there's kind of been mixed reactions where some people have said, do you know what, it's a little bit more. And for most students, we're never going to end up paying off our tuition fees anyway. So this is basically irrelevant news. And some have said, this is the worst thing ever, and how can they keep putting up tuition fees? What side of it do you and Save the Student stand on?
Well, I should say as a starting point that we as an organisation are against tuition fees. So we don't believe that tuition fees should exist. But, you know, at the same time, you do kind of have to be a realist and accept that currently this government has no plans to abolish tuition fees. It did abandon that pledge, you know, a couple of years before the election. So if you kind of work within the kind of framework that we are going to have tuition fees, then you kind of need to have a system where universities are at least properly funded. Now, we did want universities, you know, who have seen a real terms cut in their income over the past 12 years. So over the past 12 years, fees have only gone up by £250. So it was obvious that unis needed more money from somewhere. We wanted that money to come from extra government grant funding rather than from increasing tuition fees. But, you know, the government have taken this decision to increase tuition fees, which, you know, we are disappointed by. But you've absolutely hit the nail on the head that it's such a small increase that in the grand scheme of things, you know, for those students, you know, for the minority of students who are going to repay their loans in full at some point, because obviously a significant proportion won't, for those that will, it is a very small increase to their overall level of debt and will basically amount to, you know, 4 or 5 extra months of repayments when they're in their 40s or 50s or whatever. And then for everyone else who won't repay their debt in full, this debt, this extra amount for tuition fees is literally meaningless. It's an extra amount of money that they were never going to repay anyway.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I would be in that camp of, if tuition fees didn't exist, I would be a much happier person who would be currently sitting here with a lot less debt. But that's another story for another day. But like you mentioned, for those real top earners who are going to end up paying back their tuition fee, like you said, it is minimal. And of course, they're also going to be in a privileged position in the first place to be earning the amount to pay back the full student loan in the first place. But then there's a whole they've got another case to argue for themselves as well. But we'll get into that another day. I would like to kind of pivot to the maintenance fee, because I know that's probably something you have been hugely advocating for, because it's become more and more evident over probably even, like you said, the past 3-4 years, but probably the past decade, if not longer, that the maintenance fee just does not cover the cost of trying to live your life as a student, especially like the amount of, I suppose, reimbursement or just support you're going to need from family, etc., to just live your life. So whilst you welcome this 3.1% increase, I'm assuming you do welcome it because any increase is helpful, how much further did they need to go?
Well, yeah, again, you're absolutely right that, yes, universities have seen a real terms cut to their income, but so have students. So we've always said, you know, going back pre-cost of living crisis, we've always said the maintenance loan is not enough for a student to live on. But during the cost of living crisis, with inflation being as high as it was, there were more real terms cuts to the value of the maintenance loan, to the extent where, if you compare it to before cost of living crisis, students are now in real terms up to £2,000 worse off than they were, as I say, pre-cost of living crisis. So that's a substantial drop from an amount that, you know, in the first place wasn't really enough. Now, along with increasing tuition fees, as you said, the government have increased maintenance loans by 3.1%, which, again, as you say, is better than nothing. But I think it is also worth pointing out that even the last government increased the maintenance loan by, you know, the same measure as this government, which is a forecast rate of inflation. So that 3.1% is just what they forecast inflation to be. Even the last government did that. And, you know, we make no secret about the fact that they were not doing enough, in our opinion, to help students. So, yeah, to kind of put it into a very kind of brief summation, no, this isn't really enough to help students live. And we need to see a lot more from this government going forward so that students can actually afford to stay at university.
Do you have any kind of data or statistics in terms of the actual absolute amount that's lacking between how much a student will get from a maintenance loan versus how much they need from a maintenance loan?
Yeah, we do. So every year we publish our National Student Money Survey. And in our most recent survey, the shortfall between the average amount that a student receives from their loan and the average cost of living was £504 a month, which means every month a student's having to find £504 just to meet their living costs. I think there are two important things to note with that as well. One is that if you go back to 2020, that shortfall was £223, which is obviously still too much, but you now fast forward 4 years and it's over double that amount. And the other thing to note is that the living cost figures that we get from our survey, that's what students tell us they are actually spending on their living costs. And obviously, so many students in our survey will already be cutting back on so many different things. So for instance, you know, around 2/3 of students tell us that they skip meals at least some of the time. So in context, those living cost figures that students are giving us, those are already the kind of bare bones amounts that students are paying to live on. Ideally, their living costs would actually be a little bit higher and they can afford to live, you know, in a kind of less impoverished, less on the breadline kind of way. But at the moment, we're talking about £500 less every month than, you know, a very, very, very bare bones basic kind of condition of living.
Well, that's quite shocking because in my head, £200 or £250 per month is like a little bit of a side job. You could work weekends to fill that in. When you're looking at £500 plus, and like you said, that's the bare bones, so probably a little bit more than that. You're looking at essentially working as much as you can outside of studying hours. Even though the difference doesn't sound that much, it is quite a lot because you've got to bear in mind these are some of these students are full-time students who require essentially a full working day to just be focused towards their degree. And then beyond that, they need to be working evenings, weekends, holidays.
Yeah.
Which is a scary reality because, yeah, like we said, not everyone's in the privileged position where they can get that top up filled in by, you know, friends, family, savings or whatever other access they have.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pretty scary times. What should or what could the government be doing right now or in the future budgets or at any point to, I suppose, support students facing higher costs? Is there anything they can do beyond literally just changing these maintenance loans?
That is obviously the number one thing that we want is for them to increase maintenance funding, ideally in the form, at least partially with some grants as well. Beyond that, though, I would say there are some things they could potentially do. So they have a renters reform bill that they're looking to kind of push through Parliament that the last government did start, but then stopped. But crucially, with the last government, one thing they did was change it so that students will be removed from those kind of protections that that bill was offering. Now, ideally, students would be involved within the kind of legislation that comes through, because among many, many other things, it would hopefully protect students from kind of quite severe rent increases as well. So that would be one thing off the top of my head that aside from kind of all the student stuff, you know, the government could do. I guess one other thing that they have done, which is helpful, is increasing the minimum wage and looking to move towards a system whereby people of all ages are paid the same higher rate of minimum wage as well. So that's one thing the government has done, which could help students.
What about universities? What responsibility do they bear in looking after their students? Because I know we're speaking about government policies in particular, but do universities have any, I suppose, responsibility to ensure the safety of their students being able to live whilst attending them?
Yeah, they absolutely do. And to their credit, lots of universities, again, particularly during the cost of living crisis, have done a huge amount to help support their students, you know, particularly within the constraints of their own financial challenges that they're facing. So lots of universities, for instance, have either kind of expanded or increased the amount of money available that's available within their hardship funding, which is available for the students who are facing the most pressing financial issues. But they've also done things like, you know, making warm spaces available, offering free access to showers and microwaves, sanitary products as well. So lots of universities are doing stuff like that. But I would urge particularly those who aren't, you know, struggling financially or can afford to help students more to absolutely do that. Because again, the maintenance funding has not gone up by anywhere near enough. So, you know, in the meantime, we're going to need universities to step up where, if and where they possibly can.
Absolutely. All right, let's now switch to the only party that we haven't really spoken to or about so much, which is the actual students themselves. Obviously, we're looking at responsibility from the government, responsibility from universities. But what advice can you give to students who are struggling financially, even ones that were struggling prior to this increase in maintenance loan, that might be looking at this as some relief, but like you mentioned, not enough relief in any way, shape or form? What can they be doing?
Yeah, so one thing I would always say, and I may have even said it on your show before, so forgive me if I have, but it definitely bears repeating, is that bursaries, grants and scholarships are not just for the students with the highest grades or from a low income background or who excel in a sport or anything like that. You know, those probably do make up, I would say, maybe the majority, you know, maybe 60% of bursaries, grants and scholarships. But there are a huge number out there that are available to students for all kinds of weird and wonderful reasons. So the examples I always come back to, just to underline just how niche it can be, is the Vegetarian Society, which pays £500 to students who are a vegetarian or a vegan. That's it. Simple as that. There's the Graham Trust, which in the Glasgow area, if your surname is Graham and you study at an institution in the Glasgow area, bang, straight away, £500 again. Simple as that. And again, those are two very niche examples. You might not have Graham as a surname. You might not live in Glasgow or study in Glasgow. But it does underline the fact that there are so many weird and wonderful reasons why you could be eligible for funding. So if you spend an hour, 2 hours going online searching for that funding, you might find you're eligible for something. And if at the end of that, you get a grand, 2 grand, even a few hundred pounds, it's probably going to be the best paid hour or 2 hours of your entire life. So why not do it?
Tom, you didn't bring this up on last show, and I wish you had, but this is a great surprise. I'm sorry, did you say you get some money for having your surname as Graham if you go to a Scottish university?
It's specifically in the Glasgow area.
Okay.
Yes.
Specifically in the Glasgow area. That is phenomenal. And I think if that isn't enough of an example to someone listening right now to get on the internet and start searching up, like you said, all of these kind of financial supporting schemes to help students, I don't know what will convince someone. I think I might go vegetarian right now, even though I'm not a student. I definitely would have told them I was vegetarian at uni. I mean, not just told them, actually gone vegetarian at uni.
I was going to say, I think you need to supply some level of proof. But yeah, absolutely.
I'm definitely a vegetarian. Go for your last steak meal today and then go and apply for the society tomorrow or something along those lines. But I think that's so important. And I think it's a wider lesson for life. There are so many things out there for people to get support financially. The amount of, I suppose, even government benefit schemes for the wider society that just aren't taken up. There are literally billions of pounds of unclaimed benefits. And I suppose, like you said, that's kind of a macro kind of economic outlook. But if you look at the micro economic outlook of just university students, this applies to them as well. Yeah. I suppose, is there any kind of final call to actions or specific things you would like to say to any of the parties we've spoken to or about before we end this interview?
Well, yeah, I mean, specifically if we're talking political parties, then I would absolutely urge Labour to kind of fulfil their manifesto promises to deliver for students, because I would argue that so far they haven't really done that. In terms of final calls to action for students, then again, just reiterate that bursary point, because there is so much funding out there that goes unclaimed every year, in part because students don't know they're eligible. So spend an hour, spend 2 hours looking for the funding, because as I say, it could be the best paid 1 or 2 hours you ever have in your life.
And for you really smart students out there who are Googling right now how to legally change your surname, let me know if you find any answers. Tom, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it.
No problem, man. Thank you.
Cheers. Well, there you go. How about that? I will now be referred to as Gabriel Graham going forward in life. And I will be reapplying to a Glasgow-based university. That is absolutely brilliant and the best niche knowledge I've ever heard in my entire life. And it was almost good enough to take over Money Tip of the Week, which we have now arrived at. But not quite just yet, because I can't repeat the same fact so many times. But maybe I'll make it next week's Money Tip of the Week. But on that note, it is time to share with you one small actionable piece of financial, well, I suppose a financial tip that you can take away to actually improve your finances. I say right now, but let's be honest, you should wait till the end of the show and then implement it then. And this week, it's back to that Bank of England base rate. Like I said, they have changed the base interest rate from 5% to 4.75%. But what action can you take? Well, number one is if you are on some kind of mortgage that tracks the rate, the mortgage rate, please, please, please double check that this base rate change has been implemented or is about to be implemented in terms of how much you pay. You should be saving money almost immediately on your mortgage if it tracks the base rate. And number two, if you are a saver and you have a savings interest account right now, which most of you please should have easy access or otherwise, cash ISA, easy access, fixed rate account, you name it, whichever one is paying you interest. Right now, I'm getting an easy access interest of 5.17%. If you're not getting somewhere at least near 5%, I want you to really spend 20 minutes moving your money into a high interest savings account, because a lot of them are going to be dropping right now. The one you're in might, right, the place that you save with right now might have already dropped their interest rates. So please don't miss out on this free extra money. All right, guys. Well, stick around, because like I said earlier, we're going to be joined by Kia Commodora after this short break, a content creator, award winner, author, and the founder of Pennies to Pounds.
Fubar Radio.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the crying, truth. Crying. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back, and we learned our lesson. From these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register-to-vote.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Jill Jarrison, my SIS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously they can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, "What the fuck are those?" And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
What would you be advising the Labour leadership to do at this point?
My view is just apologise. I went to the theatre last night. I'm with my wife and family, and as I'm walking, a bloke says very loudly, John McDonnell, has he paid for his tickets? I went back to the bloke, said, yeah, I did pay for my tickets, and I always do. What that whole ticketing thing and all the free gifts thing doesn't just damage those individuals, it damages us all, because they all think, oh, they're all the same, and we're not.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show, live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy, and joining me now on the show is a good friend of mine, an incredible personal finance educator, content creator, award winner, double award winner, author as of recently, and also the founder of Pennies to Pounds, Kia Commodore. Welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. What a great introduction.
I know.
What a
great one. Probably one of the best ones I've ever done. It flows so easily off the tongue.
That was blowing off, so thank you so much for that.
All right, a question I've never asked you before, so this is actually a great time for me to just have a good chat about you on the show, which is, why did you start Pennies to Pounds? What's the origin story?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I had always been interested in money. I had my first ever business at 9 years old.
Wow.
I was knitting scarves and selling scarves. Yeah, I've been entrepreneurial for a long time. And then it was when I got to university. I think a lot of people, I'd moved away from home. So for many people, that was their first time experiencing managing money. I was fortunately good at it because my parents had taught me and I'd got a lot of lessons as I grew up. So my friends would turn to me to learn and I'd educate them on how to budget. I even got all my flatmates together. We'd budget monthly all of our money. That was me. And then I realized, you know what, if my peers are struggling, there's probably people our age as well who are also struggling. So I turned to YouTube initially in 2018. And then I put that on pause, carrying studying. And then a year later, the Help to Buy iSelch, you obviously know about, was coming to a close. I did a Twitter thread on it. That went viral. And then the rest is history.
Damn, a Twitter thread on Help to Buy ice is going viral. And people say that money's boring, eh? No, it ain't.
I know. Look at that. That went viral. And look, I'm here today. So are you.
The rest, as they say, is history. One thing that I know you say a lot is you aim to kind of make money accessible to everyone. You want to get rid of the jargon, get rid of the complications around money, make sure that everyone understands it's super easy. What's that one thing about finance? What's that one term that you hate the most?
I think the one term, I think hate is a strong word, but the one term I would
despise.
But the one term I would vote to probably change is pension. Just because talking to young people about pensions, they automatically switch off. They think it's for old people, that's my parents, my grandparents. When in reality, you and I both know that the earlier you get onto your pension, contributing, looking at where it's going, the better it is for the longer term. So I think pension is a very old school word. It doesn't sound great. It doesn't sound young. I feel like we need to reinvent it.
No, that doesn't sound cool. We should say like second life.
Second life. You know what? I'd be behind second life.
Second life's cool, but I'm sure there's a lot of 50-year-olds listening who are like, what are you saying, second life? What are you on about? Don't be rude. I think for me, it would be budgeting, because budgeting is probably the most, like, if I say to someone, do you budget? They'll be like genuinely, like, sounds so, probably similar to pension. But budgeting is, like, one of the things that can transform your financial life. And because it's made out to be such a boring thing, people just avoid it like it's the plague. Whereas if it was called, like, not Second Life, Second Life's not great, but, like, I don't know, Free Yourself. I don't know.
Free Yourself, yeah.
I'm getting a little bit too, I think, like, psychological here. But something along those lines. I would love to change that. Okay, let's shift gears. You are an author.
I have
just released a book.
I have.
And it's called How to Handle Money.
It is. It really is.
Let's talk more about it. What made you write a book? Who's it for? Why is it needed? Tell us everything.
So for me, writing a book, I think, has always been a thing I wanted to do. I used to write when I was younger. I used to enter competitions and actually win some competitions when it comes to writing. So when I started, obviously, educating around personal finance, writing a book was one of my goals. However, I wasn't really sure what kind of book I wanted to write. So I'd gone throughout the last couple of years kind of figuring out what book I wanted to write. Then How to Handle Money, which it now is, came into play. So my publishers, HarperCollins, approached me in terms, because they wanted me to write a book, and this book is aimed at a younger demographic, so it's aged 11 plus.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was very fitting, and I feel like that was the right book to write, just because I really got into money at around that age, yet there wasn't any money books at that time for that age demographic. And I had books on everything, Gabriel. I had books on the ancient Egyptians, all the way through to like politics, everything, but money was the only thing missing on my bookshelf. So it felt great to be able to fill that void. And yeah, How to Handle Money is essentially a beginner's guide to personal finance. So all the things that we talk about, whether it's saving, budgeting, all the way through to understanding your payslip, national insurance, taxes, that book covers everything.
So necessary as well. And I would really advocate people who are thinking about getting this book but might have been turned off by the fact you said 11 plus. Do not let that turn you off, because I'm going to be honest, I don't know the actual statistic, but if we try to look at the actual financial literacy age of the average person in this country, my guess would it would be somewhere around 11 or younger.
I actually looked at it the other day. I think the average is around 9 years old.
There we go. So yeah. If you feel like you aren't maybe so great with money, this book is probably the perfect launch pad to actually get you interested into your finances. So go and check it out, How to Handle Money. I'm sure it's available everywhere and anywhere. Am I right?
It is everywhere and anywhere. Yeah, bookshops and online on like places like Amazon.
Absolutely, absolutely love it. Okay, let's go back to kind of finances. I mean, that is your bread and butter. What would be kind of your number one tip if someone said to you, all right, stops you in the street, I've got 60 seconds, can you make me a little bit better with money? What's one thing that you would dive into with them straight away?
Oh, that's a really good question. What's one thing? I think when I have conversations with people, a big thing is often, and this might be slightly younger, but big thing is around being able to save. Now, when I say that, many people can take money and put it aside, but I find that a lot of people have an issue with leaving that money there because they dip into it, they get tempted, you know, life, you might be out and you've budgeted £20 to be out, you think, oh, I'll just transfer 30. A lot of people have that problem. So I think one thing I always talk about is there's two things. It's the oversaving, which is what I call it. When people say, I get paid £1,000, I'm going to save £900. That's probably way too much. If you have an account of your expenses, you know, your outgoings, everything. So you need to save a realistic amount that you can stick to. And that might be £50, but that's absolutely fine if you can stick to it and not dip into it. And on the flip side, people who struggle to save, I always say, look at getting a savings account that has no online banking, because
wow.
The accessibility is the big issue. If you know that you've got a savings account and your current account with the same bank, when you log in and you can see both, the transfer is very easy. If you now have a savings account, which you have to walk into the bank and show ID to move money across, that resistance often makes you double think, do I need this money or can it just stay there? And I think that can really help if you're someone who wants to save but maybe struggles to keep it there.
I love that. And by the way, Kia could give you a lot more information when it comes to finance. I literally just threw her 60 seconds, proper threw under the bus there to be like, give me one thing right now. But I think that's brilliant advice, is to kind of utilize friction to improve your financial habits. And like, it doesn't have to be like just finding a bank that doesn't have a digital service. Doing something as simple as deleting the app off your phone is just like a first basic step. If that doesn't work, then obviously you can start to take it to the extreme, or you can go extreme straight away, like we said, and go to one of those good old-fashioned banks that literally don't have a website and withdraw. Although I'm not sure how many of those still exist today. But yeah, just doing things like deleting apps off your phone.
To be fair, a lot of the traditional banks, you know, your normal high street banks, when you open up a savings account, you have to opt in to online banking. So you can just not opt in and then have no online banking to it.
You mentioned about when you do happen to have conversations with people about money, that's often something that comes up, this kind of ability to save, but not ability to hold those savings. It's quite interesting that you have conversations full stop with people about money, because it's one of the hardest things to talk about. People hate it. It's a taboo. Everyone knows this very well. But you are quite literally doing the opposite. You go onto the internet to talk about a taboo topic. What is your advice to other people as to why they should start being more open about talking about money, or what the benefits are in the first place?
Talking about money should be commonplace, yet it's not. The reason for that is when you're in your job or employment, understanding how much people are earning can help you. If it's people in your role or adjacent to that, you should know if you're being underpaid, paid the right amount, or paid more than your colleagues. If you're talking about families, relationships, it's important to talk about money, especially in romantic relationships, because that's going to be a big issue if you guys come together. So I think we need to make it more commonplace to have those conversations. However, I recognize we live in a society, especially in the UK, where we don't, it's not very comfortable to talk about money. So I think it is taking those small steps to begin that. I always say that a good way to get people to talk about money, and I've practiced this over the years and I think I've found the way, a good way to get people comfortable is to talk about yourself. So for example, I have friends who now are very open with me about money, but they weren't before. But I would just say, you know, we go out for a coffee and I'm like, you know what I'm doing? I'm currently saving towards X and I'm doing this because I want to achieve Y. Are you saving towards anything? Now that opens the door, because I've shared something and I've been vulnerable with my friends or whoever you're talking to. Now they feel like they're able to do the same. And then the more you have those conversations, you might find it gets slightly deeper. Like I say with a lot of my friends, I know how much they earn. I know what they're trying to achieve because they feel very comfortable talking about money with me now. But it is just kind of opening that door and allowing people to feel comfortable enough with you to have those conversations.
I think that's a brilliant tip. Sharing something about yourself before going straight into other people and asking them questions about themselves, because the barriers will go up straight away. Whereas what you're doing is you're just trying to eat. You've got to ease people into this stuff. It ain't easy. It's really not easy. So I think that's a really lovely piece of advice. And one other thing that I often say, especially, for example, within romantic relationships, is where it's a bit more okay to actually ask someone something because, you know, like you've got good intentions, hopefully. But instead of saying, you know, what should we save towards? What's our future? How much debt are you into a couple? Why don't you say, listen, finances is a really important aspect of our life going forward. Shall we talk about this next Friday? Because we've got an evening off. Let's sit down and talk about it. Because that way, instead of having going straight into the pressurized zone of talking about money, you at least can see when it's going to be and it's scheduled for that part. It's kind of like taking that first easy step towards a scary subject. So that would kind of be my advice to go on top of your advice. I kind of want to end with this question because I think it's super, super important to show that even people that are understanding of finances, write books about finances, win awards about finances. We are also human. We are also on this journey ourselves. Are there any kind of mistakes that you've made with your own money at any point in your life that you had to learn a lesson from that someone out there can learn from?
Absolutely. This one I'm being very open with is that when I was around 20, so that's about, I don't know, 6 years ago now, something like that, I had taken out, well, I applied for a credit card. I thought I got declined from it. Applied for another credit card, both got approved, and I now had £2,000 at 20 years old, and I'd spent it all. I couldn't tell you to this day, I couldn't tell you what I spent it on. I know I took friends out for Nando's. I just spent it on ridiculous stuff. I mean, £2,000 at 20 years old shouldn't be allowed. And then obviously you now realize that you need to pay it back. So one credit card was 0% interest, the other one was something like 30%. So I realized, you know what, this is actually isn't free money. And I knew that before, but you know, you've got to responsibilities. But I had put together a plan to pay that off. I believe I paid it off in about 8 to 9 months, but that meant a lot of sacrifice on my end because I wasn't earning a lot. I was working part-time, still at university, but I had sacrificed going out and spending money so I could pay back that debt. And I realized very quickly, I remember paying off the last chunk and I said, I'm never going to be in this position ever again because I understand the responsibility that I have. If I'm using credit, I'm going to use it for a certain reason or I'm going to have a plan to repay it back. And that's, I think that's the key thing. I didn't have a plan to pay it back. I just thought about the spending. Whereas now what I learned from that is just to always have a plan, know what money I'm going to put back onto it so I'm not in that position ever again.
I love that. So if you're listening to this right now, you've got two options. Number one is you can either take Kia's advice and listen to her listen to her lesson and understand that debt is not a fun thing and you can't just spend money for free from your overdraft or from your credit card and just try and avoid that and never be in that position ever in your life. Or you could go down this second option, which isn't one I would recommend, of trying to experience that yourself and learn the hard way, because that is not one. I would always go option number one. I don't know if you agree.
100%. Hopefully you can learn from my mistakes, and then it's a lot cheaper just to learn from mine than to do it yourself. That's what I'd say.
Absolutely. Well, Kia, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And where can people go and find your stuff?
You can find me on all social media under Pennies to Pounds. Pennies, IES, £2.
Love it. Well, thank you for coming onto That Money Show today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there you go, people. Kia Commodore, Pennies to Pounds. One of probably the coolest people within the personal finance education social media space. Please please check her out. Also, she pipped me to Personal Finance Creator of the Year. So, yeah, if you like me, guaranteed to like her because, yeah, she won the award. I'm not bitter. I'm cool. I'm relaxed. Anyway, it's time for your audience questions. So you guys, every week, get the chance to DM me at That Money Show. That's the handle, by the way, on Instagram. It's not just a random thing that I said there, where you can send us any of your questions. And we pick a few every single week and we like to answer them here live on the show. It's kind of a little fun thing we do. Also for you guys that are watching the live stream as well right now, this is your chance to ask a question and I can also potentially answer it here live on the show. Anything to do with money, the questions you're embarrassed to ask, you're not embarrassed to ask, you're not even sure you needed to ask in the first place, but you want to ask. This is that time. This is that place. We are in a safe space here on That Money Show. So shall we kick off with question number one from Bonnie? Question number one is, can I get a student finance refund if my salary is below the threshold due to salary sacrifice? So just to bring everyone up to speed, you only actually start repaying your student loan once you earn over a certain amount. On the latest plan that's come out, that's if you earn over £25,000 a year. But that is on your take-home pay. So your £25,000 is your take-home. If you use salary sacrifice through maybe like a cycle to work scheme or through your pension, and it brings you back below that threshold, you don't actually have to pay student finance. And sometimes because of the way that your PAYE is set up, your pay slip, your paycheck, etc., from your employer, you might automatically pay a certain amount of student finance. You do get the chance to get a refund on that money if you go back below the threshold. So yes, if your salary sacrifice brings your salary back below the threshold of where you do or do not pay for student finance, you can go on the student finance website and apply for a refund. So please do absolutely go and do that if you would like that money back, which I'm assuming you do. By the way, that like you still then have to pay it back later down the line. Probably worth saying that. A second question comes in from Gordon. I was going to do that in a Scottish accent because of the whole Graham thing from earlier today. I'm not going to do that because I'll offend someone. Gordon has asked, how do you file a tax return? Gordon, you have asked the most open-ended question I think I've ever seen when it comes to finance. But how do you file a tax return? You have two options, Gordon. You can, I assume this is like a self-assessment tax return. You can, number one, pay for an accountant to do it for you. That will save you time but cost you money. Number two is, do you need to file a tax return? And I'm going to tell you if you do in a second by going through all of the various ways why you might have to file a self-assessment. And then number three is you can do it yourself via literally typing in apply for a self-assessment form online. You download it. There are a huge amount of guides on the internet that explain how to do it. And then you just follow them through step by step. So shall we dive into how to know whether or not you need to file a self-assessment form in the first place? Yeah, let's do that. Okay. Bear with me. It's a little bit of a long list, but it's a list that's needed nonetheless. Number one, if you have any self-employment income more than £1,000 before taking off anything you can claim for tax relief, that's number one. Number two, your income from renting out property was more than £2,500. That's another one. You earn more than £2,500 in untaxed income, for example, from tips or commission. That's another one. Your income from savings or investments was £10,000 or more before tax. That's another one. You need to pay capital gains tax on profits from selling things like shares or a second home. You're a director of a company, unless it's a non-profit. You or your partner's income was over £50,000 and you are claiming child benefit. You have an income from abroad that you need to pay tax on, or you live abroad, but you have an income in the UK. Your taxable income was over £100,000, you lucky bastard. If you earn over £50,270 in the 23-24 tax year and you make pension contributions, you might have to complete self-assessment to claim back the extra tax relief you're owed. Basically, if you're a higher rate taxpayer and you contribute towards your pension, they automatically give you 20% in terms of your tax relief, but you actually are in the 40% bracket, so you should get a 40% tax relief, which you can claim back by your self-assessment. Explain that one there. Next, you are a trustee or of a trust or registered pension scheme. We're getting there, guys, we're getting there. Just bear with me for one more second. Your state pension was your only source of income and was more than your personal allowance. You received a P800 from HMRC saying you didn't pay enough tax last year. Do not want one of those. Oh, that was it. That was it, actually, guys. I thought the list was going to be far, far longer. It's also worth noting that you can also fill out a self-assessment tax return if you want to make a voluntary Class 2 national insurance contribution. Why might you want to do this? Well, it'll help you qualify for benefits such as the state pension. It says here to also mention, because this is important and I don't want to get this wrong, that since April 2024, if you are self-employed, you will no longer need to pay Class 2 national insurance contributions when you complete your taxes unless your profits are less than £6,725 and you wish to pay it voluntarily. Did I bore everyone? Was that really boring? I'm really hoping it was the opposite and someone just sat there being like, oh shit, I need to pay, make a self-assessment this year. Hopefully I woke a few of you up. And remember, you can literally, then you just register yourself as a self-assessment and you submit it on time when you have to. All the dates are online. I'm not going to start going through them. You can Google all this stuff you want. And then you're going to need lots of information, national insurance number, your unique taxpayer reference, details of, well, how much you earn and all that kind of good stuff. So yeah. Hopefully that brings you up to speed on your self-assessment. And it also brings you to the end of this show where, as promised at the start, you are now officially better with your money. But quickly, let me thank everyone. So thank you to Tom. Thank you to Kia for coming on the show today. I hope that you enjoyed the news. It was mainly positive, I think. I may or may not almost have gone down a ramble about Donald Trump, but we'll stay away from that. But anyway, you can always message us at That Money Show on all socials. You can listen to us on podcasting platforms, and we are live on FUBAR Radio.